So, good afternoon. Let's just start with an update on Kiwi Fruit and then we'll move on to other issues in a moment. So, Kiwi received an update today on the situation regarding the PSA disease. This is a serious issue, but it's important to note, though, that the experience overseas with PSA varies wildly. In a number of countries, its presence has been effectively managed with limited impact on Kiwi Fruit production. The situation in regards to eradication of PSA versus containment or management is fluid and fast changing. And the Minister for Biosecurity will be making some further comments on this shortly. However, I want to make it clear that the government is committed to working with industry to address this issue and develop a solution that ensures a prosperous and vibrant kiwi fruit industry. It is a priority for MAF and all necessary resources are being made available. As time goes on, this response is likely to require a significant financial commitment from both the government and the industry, and we stand ready to deliver this commitment as needed. A final comment, it's been pleasing to see how the government and industry have been working together in a collaborative way to address this issue. The process so far has been well managed and implemented at speed. This reinforces the strength of our biosecurity system and our primary sectors. Now I'm going to pass over to Mr. David Carter to make a few more comments, and then we'll take any questions you have on this particular issue.
Thank you, Prime Minister. It is now 10 days since MAF was called to a particular property orchard in the Te Puke region, and as time goes on, we have now developed a far more accurate picture of what we are dealing with. Urgent work is underway to determine the most appropriate plan of action for PSA, but it is important that we take time to get our action plan right and that we're not precipitous with our action. With the latest test results as of midday today, we now have 11 orchards covering 500 hectares that are showing positive PSA infections. We are increasingly of the opinion that eradication is getting increasingly difficult, but at this stage we're not ruling it out in its entirety. That fact has been communicated to industry, and we are now working closely with industry as we focus on a very aggressive program of containment. The kiwi fruit industry is completely supportive of this approach. Aggressive containment of PSA involves restricting some of the current uses on those infected sites. It may require the removal of infected plant material and its safe destruction. It may require controls on the use of artificial pollination and will require advice on the use of beehives and bees to assist in the pollination of crops. It will certainly require the cleaning, disinfecting of orchard equipment and some controlling on the movement of people and orchard equipment from one property to another. It will also probably require further spraying of infected vines. Those measures are still to be finalised, and we will be doing that, working very closely with the kiwi fruit industry. It is true that our eradication has always been our number one aim, but in looking at what has occurred in other countries, Japan, Korea, and Italy, it is worth noting that no other country in the world has ever successfully eliminated PSA. One good bit of news is at this stage, despite quite significant testing around the rest of the kiwi fruit growing areas of New Zealand, we are dealing with a contained area within Te Puke region stretching across approximately 23 kilometres. Over the weekend, we did some testing using library material from Landcare Research, testing soil and vines samples that were held from approximately the 1990s in an attempt to ascertain whether PSA has been here for some period of time. Those tests did not show a positive, but we cannot still rule out the fact that PSA may have been with us for a considerable period of time. I will be meeting with the industry again here in Wellington on Wednesday as we finalise plans, but as the Prime Minister said, it's likely there will be a significant financial contribution from government as we move to this aggressive containment policy. I look forward to any questions that you might have.
Minister, if PSA is found outside the Te Puke region, would that eliminate eradication as an option?
Not necessarily. It would depend where it's found and again how many orchards may be involved. But these are the sorts of decisions that we must make as new information comes to light.
You mentioned a significant financial contribution. What are we talking about here?
We have still to finalise that once we know the plan we're dealing with ongoing, but it will certainly be some millions of dollars.
Is there any ballpark at this stage?
No.
Why is eradication looking increasingly difficult? You mentioned, is it simply because it is just so comparatively widespread now?
As we've responded to the disease from the onset, we're collecting more and more samples. I would estimate we now have somewhere in the vicinity of 30,000 samples having been tested. As we get that bank of information, we're clearly dealing with an increasing number of positive infestations on the vineyards, so it makes us think that it is going to be more difficult to eradicate. And industry is coming to that point of view. Having said that, we don't want to rule it out altogether. It's fair to say that even if we embarked on an eradication program, the very first stage of that would be an aggressive containment initiative. So we're in effect starting on stage one of what could ultimately evolve to be an eradication, but I wouldn't want to give anybody an idea that it was likely that's where we will end up.
Do you think it could be much more widespread than is initially confirmed at the moment?
No, I think at this stage, the fact that we've been able to contain it so concisely within the Te Puke region is actually a good thing. But we just need to acknowledge that it could be further afield. We have been testing, but simply because you get a negative from some samples doesn't mean to say you can declare the whole region that you've been testing as clear of PSA.
When you say containment, do you mean to the orchards where it has been?
No, if we move to an aggressive containment, we'll be dealing with this area within the Te Puke region, which stretches from once for 23 kilometres, so effectively about a 12 kilometre radius.
There's been criticism that MAC have acted too slowly over this. What's your reaction to that?
I would completely deny that. I have been in the region now on two occasions and I've had nothing but fulsome praise for the way that MAF has responded. It would be inappropriate to rush to a precipitate action and then find that action may have been the inappropriate action. It was more important to get a picture for what we're dealing with, and as I've just explained, just the time we take to get that more accurate picture will mean we will end up with the best action plan to the future, the best action plan for the future of the kiwifruit industry in New Zealand.
There's also been some concern expressed today about the number of biosecurity incursions in the last year or so. Are you confident that systems haven't become too loose or up to scratch?
No, I'm absolutely confident we have the best biosecurity system in the world. We are an isolated region. We're not going to stop some... inevitably, we're not going to have a zero-risk situation. We're aware of one pasture moth result, which we think blew across the Tasman in the last 12 months. We're going to have incursions at time. We aim to minimise them. If they occur, then we need the sort of response you're seeing from MAF today, whereby you need a strategic approach depending on that incursion.
Containment didn't work on Barra or Didymo, and National was quite critical of that method when in opposition. What guarantees that containment will work for PSA?
In the case of the Varroa bee mite, it took the government of the day approximately 13 weeks to determine a plan of action. It's a very example where you need to take your time to get the picture, but then you have to be prepared to act. And this government has no intention of repeating a process established by the previous government around Varroa Beemite.
So have you established yet what strain of PSA this is and how it may have gone to the country and how it may be spreading?
We certainly haven't established how it got into the country. We haven't established whether it's the Italian strain or the Japanese strain or indeed a strain that may be a New Zealand strain.
And how it's spreading. Listen,
we are dealing with an airborne bacterium. It's not like a beetle. It's not something you can spray and successfully know you've killed. So how's it spreading? It's likely to be windborne, it's likely to be waterborne, it's certainly likely to be spread by bees with pollination, and they are in the midst of the pollination season in the Te Puke region. It's likely to be spread by people and by orchard equipment.
That makes it extremely difficult to contain, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And that's why if we move towards an aggressive containment policy, it's going to be something that we're going to have to work closely with the industry. The industry is going to have to be totally involved and committed to that aggressive containment policy.
Is that aggressive containment going to mean pulling up and burning or destroying vines? Because how else do you stop bees or insects from spreading?
It will almost certainly involve some removal of some of the worst infected vines and the destruction of that material, so that it doesn't allow the spread of that bacterium.
Do you have any idea of destruction of beehives as well?
Sorry?
Are you looking at destruction of beehives?
No, at this stage I'm not aware of any suggestion would need to destroy beehives.
Is there any advantage about how much it's going to cost the industry?
No, until we know whether we successfully are able to contain it, until we know whether the strain is going to be a serious one, or whether it's one that's been triggered by climatic events, I don't think we're in a position yet of putting any accurate assessment on what it may actually cost the industry or indeed New Zealand.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, moving right along. The most recent situation relating to Pansy Wong has again raised into the public minds questions about the international travel rebate available to members of Parliament, their spouses and ex-MPs and their spouses. Since I've become Prime Minister, more information has progressively been made available to the public about both parliamentary and ministerial expenses, including MPs' accommodation and travel costs and ministerial credit card use. I believe this greater transparency has been positive. As the Speaker has pointed out, the overall cost of the taxpayer for overseas trips taken under the international travel rebate is deducted from the overall pool of money set aside for MPs' remuneration. However, it is clear that there is no public confidence in this system and it undermines public confidence in the institution of Parliament, and that is not a good thing for our democracy. The strong view of National Party MPs is that this entitlement has now outlived its usefulness and should be abolished as soon as possible. To that end, I have today advised the Speaker of the House that National's strong view is that the entitlement should end. I've asked the Speaker to refer this matter to the Remuneration Authority, which is independent of all MPs and political parties. It should be for the Remuneration Authority to determine how best to abolish the entitlement and to determine what changes, if any, should be made to MPs' salaries. But it would be my expectation that if any change to MPs' salaries was to be countenanced, it should be very modest indeed. In a practical sense, what I'd like to see happen is for the travel entitlement for all existing MPs and their spouses to be abolished as soon as possible. You'll be aware that because of changes made before the 1999 election, MPs elected at the 99 election or afterwards no longer enjoy an international travel discount when they leave Parliament. That said, there are MPs who are either currently in Parliament and were elected prior to 1999, or a host of ex-MPs who do get the grandfathered travel discount when they leave. It would be our recommendation that because it is not practical to retrospectively renegotiate employment conditions of this group of current and former MPs, that their entitlement should remain. Looking at the National Party caucus, we would expect around a dozen of the 58 MPs would fall into this category. What I've outlined for you is the National Party's position. I'll now leave it for other leaders to reflect on their own positions. But on the wider issue, of whether MPs' remuneration and expenses should be totally determined by an independent body, it is my view that this is a matter now worthy of consideration. As such, the Law Commission is reporting on these matters shortly and will provide the opportunity for further debate and consideration of this matter. What I am signalling to you today is that I am open to debating the merits of this suggestion. Move on, if I may, to APEC. As you know, this morning I returned from a very successful APEC in Japan. The TPP gained real momentum, with Malaysia and Vietnam confirming their membership, and Japan's Prime Minister Khan signalling strong interest in joining. The chance to have all nine leaders in the same room was invaluable, and all expressed a strong commitment to the TPP as a way to accelerate trade growth. Securing an agreement to begin FTA negotiations with Russia was also a highlight for us. When completed, this will be Russia's first FTA. Our exports to Russia may currently only be $187 million a year, but Goldman Sachs has forecast that Russia, with an economy of around about $1.28 trillion US dollars now, will be the largest economy in Europe by 2050. On a personal level, the warm relationship has developed between President Medvedev and myself bodes well for the future. It was also good to catch up with the Chilean Prime Minister Stephen Harper, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Chilean Prime Minister Piñera, and also to have some time with President Obama at the gala dinner where we were seated together. Trade is vitally important because it's about jobs and gatherings like APEC, and they're all about cementing the relationships that give the momentum we need to secure these trade deals. In terms of the weekend, as you're aware, this weekend the people of Mana will be selecting their next MP. As I have pointed out during this campaign, it would be a very long shot for National to win what has been a safe and long-standing Labour-held seat. It would be the equivalent of Labour taking the seat of Bay of Plenty from National. That said, Heke Parata has run an outstanding campaign and has demonstrated that over the past few years, all of her hard work in the electorate has given her an intimate knowledge of the local issues. On this basis, we are actively encouraging all National supporters who live in the Mana electorate to get out and vote for Heke Parata on Saturday. In terms of my ministerial activity, tomorrow I'm at caucus and question time, and late morning I will launch a spinal injury charity campaign at Thorndon New World. On Wednesday I'll be speaking to the Federated Farmers National Council meeting. On Thursday I travel to Nelson to speak at the Aquaculture New Zealand Conference. On Friday I travel to Dunedin where I'll open the Natural History New Zealand building and then fly back to Auckland in the evening to present my Pacific Island Youth Awards at the Telstra Centre. Saturday is obviously the by-election, and subject to any changes in my diary, it's my expectation I'll be at Hickey's function on Saturday night. I'll also be visiting the Mana electorate later in the week. More details will be released closer to the time. Tomorrow evening, the House will move into urgency in order to gain extended sitting hours so a range of bills can be considered before the Christmas adjournment. A list of bills is available from the Leader of the House's office. Questions? Well, I, as a matter of courtesy, rang the Speaker this afternoon to indicate to him that I was going to make the announcement in relation to our desire to see the international travel discount abolished. He was receptive to the proposition that I put to him. And I guess now he'll wait and see what other party leaders think.
Because the Speaker was planning to make an announcement himself this afternoon. Is that why he cancelled it? And was he planning to announce a similar review?
I don't know about that. He didn't raise the issue.
Company's office records have shown that a company involved with Sammy Wong and Jenny Shipley are both registered to the same address as Pansy Wong's electorate office. Do you know anything about that? And if that's the case, is that going to be something that you'd want to have looked at as part of, you know, the inquiry into who travels
up there? Well, no idea about the first point. In relation to the second point, I've no clue whether they would look at that because the terms of reference are really in relation to the use of the travel discount and whether that was appropriately used. So if there was some correlation between the two, I'm sure they'd look at it. Otherwise, I'm not quite sure, you know, the point of a
Well, there'd be an issue with her if she was having business mail sent to an electorate address, which presumably has got some sort of taxpayer funding attached to it.
Look, I think you've got to be very careful when you start looking at mailing addresses. I mean, look, people have mailing addresses for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes it's simply that they move houses and it's just convenient to have a location that they know that they're going to constantly be at. I receive mail to the level 9 of the Beehive for a variety of different reasons, just because I know at least for a certain period of time I'm there.
This is someone else sending mail. It's not Pansy Wong sending mail to another address for her own convenience. It's her husband and a business partner.
Well, you need
mail.
To ask her about it, but... Yeah, it's of itself, it's not that sinister.
Would you expect one of your MPs to actually front up and answer questions about this sort of thing? Pansy Wong hasn't answered any questions now for a number of days.
Well, my advice to her, I haven't spoken to her prior to the decision that she made to stand down from Cabinet, but my advice to her would be not to answer any questions until the report is prepared and she can reflect on that report, because you will ultimately be asking her questions that, at least when I spoke to her on Thursday night from Japan, she didn't have those facts and therefore couldn't provide the answers. Until she has that report, I think it's really a waste of time answering those questions.
But this is pretty straightforward. I mean, you have the company's records, you have her electorate address, and as you've just said yourself, this is probably not going to be included in that investigation. Yeah. So are you saying that she shouldn't be answering any questions about things that are raised in the interim?
That would be my advice to her.
Even that aren't included in the actual inquiry?
That would be my advice to her.
If the report shows there was repeated use of that for business-related travel, would you think that would call into question her future as an MP?
I don't want to speculate on that.
Do you have any concerns about your April 2009 trip where Mr. Wong was also on there and his activities on that trip?
Well, I recall him being there, but I, from one of the functions I was outside that, I don't know what activities he undertook when he was there. Again, that would be a matter for him to answer, and I'm sure that that report will look at that matter if he used the travel discount to go on that trip. So again, it would be better for others to answer that.
Are you aware of any other circumstances with any travel MPs where something similar may have happened, as in this case?
No, I'm not aware of it.
Have you made inquiries?
I haven't, and the reason for that is that it was my understanding that prior to the change made by Speaker Lockwood Smith, that you could only use travel discount for holiday or pleasure reasons, not for business. That was my understanding of the rules. The Speaker did change that to extend it to a parliamentary purpose, and so it would be my expectation that my MPs would understand that and apply the rules as they were designed. Now, people can always have different interpretations and make mistakes, but I operate on the principle that my MPs follow the rules as they are prescribed, unless I'm otherwise advised.
How were your MPs consulted on the party's position now of doing away with that travel food?
There'd been some discussion in our caucus, I think either last Tuesday, if I was at caucus, time flies when you haven't done, I think last Tuesday. And there was a broad consensus then. I raised the matter at Cabinet when we met today, and there was unanimous support from Cabinet, and on that basis we proceeded.
And we're just talking about the travel subsidy aspect of it. I think from memory there are 4 or 5 components of those sort of extra top-ups. Are you talking about all of those? I mean, obviously superannuation's one, but the others that relate to travel and that sort of thing, or just that specific international travel discount?
We'll talk about international travel discount.
In terms of a wider review, would it look at those other issues as well, though?
Well,
I mean, if you're going to do away with that, presumably if you have a wider review, it's still going to be the other element.
So there's 2 issues, right? So the first is the international travel discount, and our view is that that should be eliminated, and the REM authority should go in and look at the issue of what recommendations it might make as a result of the elimination of that discount. The second is the wider issue of whether an independent authority should look at all entitlements available to MPs. They already are responsible for a great many of them, so they set or make recommendations around compensation, around the bulked up allowance in terms of other aspects of entitlements from the MP. But there are some that still fall within the Speaker's purview, and I think when you see the Law Commission's report, haven't seen the final draft, but I've seen some earlier work, you will see that there is a case put forward for an independent authority to look at that. I think that is a useful vehicle for this discussion to take place. I think if we are going to move to that system, personally there needs to be a recognition that the work and environment of an MP is quite different from many other jobs, and so it's important that whatever rules and however they were set recognise the nature of that job, but I wouldn't rule out that an independent body could successfully carry out all of those functions.
And would you think that possibly just transferring all of that to the Remuneration Authority might be the model to go for?
Look, it could be, but I mean, I think we need to have that debate in a detailed way.
Well, what are your expectations about what happens next? You've had this conversation with the Speaker, what would the reason be?
I'm guessing a few minutes after you get out of here, if your colleagues aren't already, they'll be on the phone to other party leaders. They will all agree that it's a good idea for it to go, is my guess, and wait for me to do something. And then I think the much more serious debate occurs about what happens beyond here in terms of an independent body looking at these matters. And I think we'll have an opportunity through the Law Commission's report and others actually to reflect on that and to work our way through whether that's the future track that we take, and if so, how that might operate.
You've said any corresponding increase in salaries you personally would like to see as modest. Do you just think it would be too hard to sell for the public and may potentially expose the MPs to even more criticism if they were given $30,000-$40,000?
Well, firstly, for the most part, New Zealanders are not enjoying large pay increases. So for MPs to take what would look like a pay increase, even if it wasn't, is frankly quite a difficult sell. Secondly, it's quite a complex thing to actually calculate, because if you just take an example of our cabinet, Bill English theoretically can have a 90% travel discount. Theoretically, I think, because of my tenure, I could have a 50% and Stephen Joyce is zero. So any across-the-board adjustment would be really hard, because how do you compensate for all those different parts of it? So, I think there's ways and ways to think your way through it, but personally, I'm not supportive of a whopping great big increase to MPs just because the travel perk that they used to enjoy has been eliminated.
Well, the Remuneration Authority works out as an average of $9,000, so...
That's unacceptable to me.
Prime Minister, do you have a view on whether or not MPs are adequately or overcompensated at present in general?
In general, I think it's sort of adequate. It's never going to be the highest paid job in the world, and there are lots of other jobs you can engage yourself in if you want to earn more money. But those who come to Parliament, I'll take it that they come here for the wider reasons that they want to make a difference to New Zealand, not just about compensation.
The public might have a view that they're overcompensated.
Yep, there will be some people in the public who think we're overcompensated. But on the other side of the coin, you know, as I've often said, you know, pay peanuts and you get monkeys. And, you know, we're talking about 120 odd people who are going to be making the rules for New Zealand, and I think you've got to get a range of people in there that can reflect good lawmaking and good rulemaking. So, you know, on balance, I think the comp is about right. If you look at the chief executives who work for me, they earn more than me, even though I'm Prime Minister of New Zealand. So, I'm not arguing I'm undercompensated, but nor would I argue that as the role of Prime Minister, it's overcompensated.
But isn't your response part of the problem in terms of the politicisation of the pay rates of MPs, in the sense that if you just gave it over to an independent remuneration authority, let them do it without any pressure about what the increase should or shouldn't be?
Yep, and that's all well and good until you record it on Radio New Zealand and all the rest of you put it in the newspaper, in which case you won't reflect it like that. You won't reflect it as a nice independent group of people who are suggesting we get a pay increase. You will say that we are responsible for a pay increase. And as the New Zealand Herald ran recently, an entire front page of me with theoretically a hat out asking for more, even though I didn't want any more. So, look, the reality is you can't take the politics out of politics. So, yep, I think an independent group should look after this, should make recommendations, but in the end, I will inevitably be asked for a view, and I'm exercising my view, which is I don't think there should be a large increase if this international travel discount is removed.
Is there a possibility that the Remuneration Authority, since it's been operating, has in fact adjusted MPs' salaries to levels which are so high now that the public is quite concerned about them, and that that's part of the problem, that the authority itself is being a little bit too generous?
That's not what gets raised with me. So, look, there'll always be some people that hold that view, but as a general rule, the issues that get raised sometimes are too many MPs, and I think as a general rule, the international travel discount for holiday purposes and not for a business purpose has seemed to be a very unusual thing and a hard thing for New Zealanders to reconcile in the modern day.
Will Hiki Furuta be promoted to a cabinet position?
Look, I can't answer who will replace Pansy Wong as cabinet. What I can tell you is it's not my expectation I'll make a decision this week. I would expect making a decision sometime in the foreseeable future, but it certainly won't be this week.
Has that got, was any weighting, the Mana election, did that have any weighting on your decision on whether to hold off or not?
No, I want to spend a little bit of time thinking through the issue.
Do you think it would just be the one position of Bill, or you look at it as an opportunity to have a wider reshuffle?
Just the one, I think, is my expectation.
So you're still not really looking at a sort of a
mid-term
reshuffle?
No. Really? I mean, you know, what I said about a week ago is, notwithstanding that it's now 19, not 20, still be an accurate statement. I think my ministers are doing a good job. And actually, for that fact, I think Pansy Wong did a very good job. I think she's allowed herself to be tripped up by the rules, and she's paid a very heavy price for that. But actually, as a minister, I thought she did a good job.
Is it your expectation that all of Pansy Wong's portfolios will go to one new minister?
No, I don't think you can make that assumption.
Did you seek an assurance from your other ministers today that none of them might be tripped up by the same sort of mistake?
Well, I didn't categorically put it in those terms, but I'm sure ministers understand the rules, and there's a great many rules that operate in Parliament, and I expect them to meet those rules.
Mark Weldon on Sunday had a pretty scathing attack on the financial markets. He said the NZX might have to leave New Zealand if it goes through like that. Would you like the NZX to stay in New Zealand? And
yeah, well, I think it's a given that we want the NZX to remain in New Zealand. Secondly, I literally saw his comments on the plane when I flew back on Sunday night, and I intend to take that matter up with both him and the minister. And the intention of that bill is to strengthen financial market regulation in New Zealand. That's important, and that's consistent with what's happening around the world. If there are genuine concerns, then we'll look at addressing those.
With the currency, is there a danger that only commodity exporters are really going to survive the next few years if the dollar situation with the US stays like it is?
Well, I'm more optimistic than that, but it's certainly more challenging. And one thing that's worth remembering is that a big part of our economy and therefore our exports is Australia. So one big advantage we have is that a lot of our non-commodity-based exporters are exporting to Australia, and they're not suffering from a very high exchange rate, in fact, which are very competitive there. Secondly, the government's been making a lot of moves around its economic reforms to try and take the pressure off our exporters and off our business community, whether it's labour market reform or RMA reform, tax reform. So I think that's helping. And there will always be cyclical flows, but there's no question for those that are exporting in US dollars that are non-commodity linked, it's very difficult to combat a US-New Zealand exchange rate, which is overvalued.
So is this currency thing being overblown, do you think, with the whole... Because most of our exports are to Australia, those who are exporting to the US are generally commodities, and prices have risen. Is it being overblown?
Well, a lot. It's not just to the US. Obviously, a lot of trade is conducted in US dollars. No, I think there's a range of significant areas where people are exporting and they're not commodity linked, and it is in US dollars. So, no, there's concern.
And are you worried with the quantitative easing in the US? That's not being often reinvested in the US. Are you worried that some of that money is going to find its way into New Zealand?
Well, inflation's running at reasonably low levels in New Zealand. So, that's the first thing. Second thing is we haven't actually seen a growth. I mean, that's been one of the issues technically. We haven't seen credit growth taking place in New Zealand. In fact, it's been going the other way in terms of business credit growth. So arguably, if a little bit more cash sloshed into New Zealand, that might actually help economic growth. But we're not unhappy with the rebalancing we're seeing from the private sector. It's a little painful for the retail sector at the moment, but overall, we want New Zealanders to save more.
Finally, on the high New Zealand dollar again, do you think that could lead to New Zealanders importing more, and could that help not help the rebalancing?
Well, technically, a higher exchange rate makes imports more attractive and exports less attractive, so by definition, it affects that balance. But what's happening at the moment is New Zealanders aren't necessarily importing more. What they're actually doing is just consuming less, and so that's actually making some of the goods and services cheaper, taking the pressure off inflation. So there's always two sides to that coin.
Just going back to Mana, yeah. Phil Goff says that if there's low voter turnout, that might make a Labour victory, that might place it in jeopardy. What realistically do you think National's chances there are, and have you done any polling?
Well, look, it's a very long shot to win Mana. I mean, the reality is, you know, governments, I don't think there's a history of a government taking a by-election in a seat that they don't normally hold. And as I said, this is one of Labour's safest seats. I think what Phil Goff is trying to do is warm you up to a reduced majority on the basis that his campaign has not been that stellar, run by his former press secretary. So my view is it's a long shot for us, but if National voters get out and support Hekia Parata, hey, who knows in the big city?
Following the East Asia Summit and the APEC meetings, what's your sense of the risk of some kind of spiral of tit-for-tat measures on currency, capital controls and even trade measures?
I think there is a slightly increased risk of retaliatory action, less so from the feeling at APEC, but my understanding is things were quite frosty at the G20 in Seoul. There's a lot of stress in the system at the moment. So you can see and could feel that tension. And actually, we raised the issue in the leaders' session. And once we had raised it, a number of other leaders came in and exercised their view. I think on balance, retaliatory action would be very negative, because the potential is, if you saw a whole lot of countries either quantitatively easing or doing something else, that you could lead to a bout of inflation in the region, that could lead to lower growth in the region, and the world is relying on the Asia-Pacific region to be the part of the world that takes us out of recession, so I would be very worried about that. I think it's also the speed of change. It's not the absolute level of your exchange rate, but the speed of change has been quite traumatic, and you certainly wouldn't want to see another significant leg down in terms of the US dollar against the New Zealand dollar. As in the US falling a lot further.
So, Nasser, did you say you're going to be in Mana on Saturday night?
It's my expectation that I will be. That's the planning at this point.
But you didn't go to Mount Albert on Friday night. Should we read something into this?
No, and they said the problem is actually, despite the reports in the paper and the way I was savaged by you all, actually previous leaders have never gone. Jim Bolger didn't go to a couple of the by-elections that were held. Apparently Shipley didn't go when there was one at some time. I think Shipley, but certainly Bolger didn't go. But, So I'm a little reluctant to go because you'll read the wrong thing into it, but realistically I'll probably be there.
Were you disappointed with the G20 outcome?
I was a bit disappointed with the G20. I think what it shows you is it was easy when they agreed what to do, and that was spend more money, because that was politically easy to sell and was pro-economic growth at that time. What's G20 is proving at the moment it's a lot more fractured when they have differing views on what the right economic prescription is.
Prime Minister, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been widely criticised in the recent book that's been published by Jane Kelsey and academics.
Yeah.
It complained particularly about its impact on sovereignty in relation to investors being able to sue sovereign governments, which is something which I understand the Australian government is not really interested in pursuing.
Yep.
Can you enlarge a little bit on the discussion at APEC around those issues?
Well, I haven't read the book, but I have seen the piece that Jane Kelsey wrote in the New Zealand Herald, and I disagree with it.
But what about the idea of investors suing sovereign governments for enforcement of investment rights?
Far-fetched.
Well, it's in NAFTA.
Good luck.
Is that sort of thing being sought? Is it being negotiated?
Not as far as I'm aware.
And it's being ruled out in that sense. The Australians apparently have all
the time. I imagine we would too. I mean, I think it's pretty far-fetched. Look, I mean, we can have a long and endless debate about the merits of free trade, but New Zealand's experience of FTAs is that they build jobs, they grow the economy, they deliver competitiveness and robustness, and they're good for New Zealand. And there'll always be some detractors from that view. That's life. But overwhelmingly, I think the consensus view in New Zealand is going down the path of free trade agreements has been good for our economy and good for jobs, good for wages.
That does seem to be the consensus view in the United States in relation to NAFTA, which this agreement is not in.
Yep. Well, they're entitled to the abuse, and I can't speak for the American people, but in New Zealand, I think if you go back all the way back to CER, there were plenty of detractors from CER. Well, but actually, it's been very successful.
Is there a difference between CER and NAFTA, though? I mean, in terms of the
CER is between New Zealand and Australia, and NAFTA is between the US and Mexico. Let's go. Thanks very much.
Thank you.